It takes a village to dress a drag queen. Behind every fierce drag queen, there's an even fiercer queen helping her look her best.
For years, Stephen Perfidia Kirkham has styled wigs for some of Broadway's biggest shows and many of your favorite drag queens and entertainers. Stephen created the unusual hair flip for Amy Sedaris' character Jerry Blank on the second season of Strangers with Candy, and he also created the new look for Cherry and Missy Yvonne on the Broadway production of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Today, Perfidia, wig stylist to the stars, joins us to talk about all the glorious big wigs from Lady Bunny to RuPaul and what it was like in the wig stock and club kid scenes of the 90s.
Plus, his friendship with Exotica princess Ima Sumac.
Who was Moi Renee and Can't You Hear Me Calling You Miss Honey?
The early years of RuPaul and D-Light.
And why all the drag queens eventually have to come to terms with being a drag queen. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. We are so excited because, hunties, we have Stephen Perfidia Kirkham here in the home studio, wig stylist to the stars. Behind every fierce drag queen, there is another fierce drag queen helping them out and making them look sickening. Welcome to Feast of Fun.
Yay, thank you. It's fun to be here.
Stephen Perfidia Kirkham. Now, Perfidia is how you're known as a drag queen for years and years and years.
Yes, and it also relates to, there's a song, Perfidia, so.
By, that was Ima Sumac, or?
No, a lot of different people did it. I'm not sure exactly who the original is, but it's from a Spanish song that I was given the name and then later discovered the song was ironic and perfect for my character.
Your drag mother gave it to you.
Yeah, International Crisis gave me the name. Yes.
That's a drag queen's name, International Crisis.
Yes, she was amazing. And a muse to Salvador Dali, so I had really good teachers.
So you, as a young military brat, moved to New York City in the early 80s.
Yep, 85.
And decided that you couldn't get into the nightclubs because you were underage. So you decided, if I dress up in drag, I can get into the clubs not only for free, but they'll buy me drinks.
Well, originally, the dressing up was in Hollywood. Because by the time I got to New York, I was already 20.
Established.
20 years old, I could drink.
Well, wait a minute. In the early 80s, the legal age for drinking in clubs was under
18 in New York.
Oh, yeah. Oh. It was state by state. And then Reagan said, if you want money for your highways, you have to raise the drinking age to 21.
I didn't know that.
And then we all got screwed.
Damn you, Reagan.
Yeah, like places like Danceteria and Area, those were the first New York things. And I would be dressed up in my LA style, which was kind of like a Motley Crue, glam, gay look. And that was working here in New York.
What was your first drag look like? Like, what can you describe it to us? Since you probably burned all the photos.
Oh, no, I love to look back at that stuff. The evolution's so much fun. I mean, when I look back and think of the first wigs and lashes, that was stuff we were doing in the 80s, going to the Odyssey Club. But real drag, titties and all, was in New York at the Boy Bar. And I always fashioned myself after slightly 60s, 50s, 60s Latin divas.
And Boy Bar was one of the big drag scenes in New York City.
Yeah, Boy Bar in 1985, up until 95, I believe, it had a 10-year run, was the nucleus for all the best newcomers in drag, including Candace Kane and Girlina. And then we even had the stars from the East Village, further east, like Lady Bunny, Taboo, Lipsinka. But the core of the Boy Bar group was Connie Girl, Glamamore, Miss Shannon, myself, Perfidia, Miss Guy, Peau de Soie. It was like a really fine, and Raven O, of course. Raven O was the choreographer, in fact. And
when did RuPaul come into the equation?
RuPaul and Bunny and Larry T had the same similar experience where me and my group of friends ended up at Boy Bar and got momentum. They ended up at Pyramid Club and started getting momentum. They latched on to Sister Dimension and another great queen, Tangela, Billy Beyond, were all the Pyramid scene, and they had a performance group. I think it was called the People Tree. I'm not sure. I think that's the name of it. And it was Larry, Bunny, and RuPaul doing a live thing. And La Homa.
Lahoma Van Zandt, who, if you've seen the Strawberry Shortcake and Star Booty and Pickle
Booty,
Surprise.
She plays Casper the Ghost.
Well, she's very light. She looks like Casper the Ghost. You went into the Odyssey Club in New York City in 1981.
Odyssey is Hollywood.
Okay.
So that was where we started wearing makeup, wearing lashes, and the whole Boy George New Romantic thing. And when I moved to New York, my influence was still rock and roll glam and the New Romantic thing.
Sure.
But that was kind of on its way out. And the thing that was coming up was this avant-garde drag from the Pyramid, where it was wild, like perhaps a Cockette influenced styles or very Lee Bowery influenced. And the Boy Bar was more of a non-traditional but classic stuff like Valley of the Dolls, and our influences were like that. And
so then the group was it like glam rock and punk was making its influence on a lot of gay men dressing up in drag?
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing how big drag was then. It was the drag explosion.
Sure.
And
it's kind of like, and so just like in evolution, when you have a explosion in biology, you have a lot of different types of expression and looks and people involved. And in 1986, it was kind of like a critical year because all you girls were done with your gigs and you drunkenly stumbled into Thompson Square Park and decided to perform for each other, which was the birth of Wigstock.
Yeah, well, that is specifically the legacy of the Pyramid Queens. The Boy Bar Queens were not included in that first drunken rambling. It was the likes of Wendy Wilde and John Sex and very legendary pyramid performers. We were invited the following year when she started to organize it to some degree to be in the show as, sure, you know, color. And the following year is when each bar started to get a section and became even more and more organized each year in its crazy, wacky way. But it was getting organized.
How many years did this event take place in Thompson Square Park?
I don't know exactly. I would say there was probably about 6 or 7 events there. I'm not sure.
And how many people attended the first year?
It was around 1,000 people, maybe 500 people. I remember being just very informal and like people just showed up. There was, you know, just a band show.
How do people
show.
Know that to go to it?
Flyers were such a big thing back then. Yeah. I mean, now with the internet, who needs a flyer? But flyers were huge and Bunny was just so popular that.
And Thompson Square, it's not the Thompson Square that is of today.
Yeah, it was definitely a seedy East Village trashy thing where drag queens could go out of the club at 5 a.m. and take over a band shell and no one would care. If anything, they would enjoy it.
And there were a lot of like drunk homeless people living in shanty towns around the area.
Well, let's not talk about Bunny too much, but but yeah, it was the genius of these talented people in contrast to these East Village people that maybe weren't seeing colorful things, that they immediately loved it. You know, instead of being angered and confused by it, they just accepted it. Because some of the homeless people or street people, I wouldn't want to say even homeless, but in New York, they're very colorful anyhow, even with nothing to do with drag. So when we added that element to it, and I give Bunny all,
they're
most
all like,
of the
we're
credit.
Getting laid tonight.
Yeah, or, you know, old ladies would be like, I used to do my hair like that. They'd want to talk to us and meet us. Funny things like Taboo would be selling lemonade on the street, and just it was such a fun neighborhood back then. There was so much going on with drag.
In the documentary Wigstock, where a lot of people who may not be familiar with you would probably know you best from, you're styling wigs for pretty much every drag queen in New York City, it looks like, in that documentary. You've done wigs for RuPaul, Lady Bunny.
Well, those are two that are the least likely. Honestly, RuPaul has been done by Matthew for so many years.
But you did do wigs for RuPaul at one point in time, did you not?
Or never? Really. I did one that I can really remember, but no, that wasn't a big thing for me. My kids were more like the people going to Copa and the people working, at Boy Bar. So that would include like the Varlas and
Varla Jean Merman.
And yeah, so...
So you did stuff for Varla Jean Merman.
One of my mentors actually did Bunny's wigs for years. His name's Bobby Miller. He's a P-Town boy now, but he was another person that had come off the heels of Studio 54 and kind of stumbled into Patricia Field and thought, what is this fabulous thing going on? And we said, well, here's Boy Bar. And he actually taught me a lot about comb outs. You know, he's a huge influence
So he was your, like, your drag Jedi. What is it? Jedi master?
Yeah, there was. I had a few really great masters. There was the guy that ran Boy Bar, Matthew Kasten, who also went on to do wigs for Mad TV and took an Emmy. I mean, he's a total genius. He helped create all of us characters in the beginning that have lasted all these years. Like I said, I always refer to me and Miss Guy and Glamour, people that are still pumping it out. And he also taught me so much about teasing hair and how to get volume. And he actually worked at the wig salon for about 4 years with me as we were building the business. And so he's another genius. And then next door to Patricia Field, there was also the Old Lady Beauty Salon. And this guy, Marcus, worked there. And he is the final, like, icing on the cake that taught me how to do the 60s roller sets, taught me all about the characters, Gene Shrimpton and Edie Sedgwick and all these things.
Because it seems like all of the drag queens of that time period were very much influencing each other. And there's a certain look that references 1960s, doo-wop, Beehive hairdos, Dusty Springfield, and you were right there in the center of it all.
I think the kids
making the wigs for those girls.
Kids of the mid 80s, all of our parents and our life was in the 60s. So all that fantasy fun stuff like Laugh-In that we didn't get to participate in, we could bring it back to life and actually have Laugh-In in the East Village. I mean, that what could be more fun?
So I think the hairstyles from the 60s are over the top hairdos. Kind of those crazy hairdos.
They lend themselves,
you know,
because
you think like in the 40s, it's just kind of classic looking.
Yeah, it can be gorgeous, but the teased hair and the whole wig stock generation, it was really so closely linked. It was such a great time.
There was a Flotilla Large DeBarge. Is that her
full name? Flotilla DeBarge, the Queen of Large.
The Queen of Large. In the documentary, she gave you a $5 cheap ass wig from Walgreens that you can buy the day after Halloween that you probably be better using as a mop. And she's trying to get you to style it into a big old hairdo.
Well, we have a wonderful relationship because, yeah, not everybody can go out and buy $100 wigs. So that's always was my forte, to take whatever you're giving me and give you the most for your buck.
And we have a couple of $5 wigs here we're going to have you create a masterpiece from.
Because I know this drag queen, her name is Saltina Obama Bouvier, and she is looking busted these days. And she needs all the help she can get. Can you help her?
Yes, yeah, sure.
Awesome.
So that video will be up on YouTube sometime, maybe later this week.
Yeah. Okay, so and you actually, because there really is no good tutorial on how to make those Lady Bunny big, crazy drag queen hairstyles, and so you're actually going to give the children's of the world the ability to spin straw into drag queen gold.
Well, I'll show them one of the classic things, which is stacking, where you stack one wig on top of the other. I mean, it's a little more common now, but it was kind of a revelation back then, because we were watching these 60s movies and we didn't really know how they were doing it, and it's all about putting the two wigs or three wigs together.
Like when I was growing up, like girls that were trying to do like beehives would take margarine tubs and put those on their head and then style their hair around that.
Wow. But, yeah. That's incredible.
So was there any like failures as drag queens? That's kind of funny. I know I remember one time in Austin, Texas, that some of the drag queens that I knew were a little sloppy and they would
put Faustina.
That wasn't me. I'm not going to say any names because I get into trouble. But she was really sloppy, and she had a sandwich, a ham sandwich, her wet, sweaty dress, and her big beehive wig in her knapsack. And she stored this in the attic and forgot it was there. And I swear to God, this is a true story. She said when she opened up the sack, there was a family of rats living inside it.
Wow.
Like a little rat baby.
So a ratty wig really does exist. Well, when you think about it, that's like kind of like if you look at a wig, that's what a rat wants to live in. It wants to live in something just that. Little nest.
Have you ever had like animals move into a wig?
Roaches? Come on. You live in New York. You must have had roaches.
No.
Never.
This is not Hairspray the Movie. I mean, I have to admit that one client in Thailand did have a cockroach in her wig because I put the two together. And she had it for a year or so, and it was covered, but... Okay.
And so when you, pulled it apart, there was a dead animal inside?
There was.
That's crazy.
Dorinka Watch A Lot of Porn is my client in Bangkok. And she does...
Those Thai people have such long names.
She's an American queen.
Okay.
Dorinka Watch A Lot of Porn.
Porn. Yeah, watch, because the Thai names quite often have that at the end. She is, she does gay trips and gay activism in Thailand. She's a really, really great friend and kind of on the divine tip, kooky looking.
She's large and in charge.
Yeah, and I helped create her persona, which, again, it was very sloppy in the beginning. I love to step in at that point and say, girl, you got to get this foundation, you got to get this wig, and you're a big girl, you need a big costume.
You're like the Johnny Appleseed of drag queens, traveling around the country and dropping little drag queen nuggets on there, making the world a more fierce and fabulous place.
I love to share what I've learned and stuff, and especially to go out of town where you're, you know, they don't have it. Like Japan, even though they have lots of big wig and hairstyling, teasing isn't really something that they're that familiar with. Yeah, because it's such a southern thing. And so I've gone there and done such great stuff there.
That's kind of where your sensibility comes from. You grew up in the South for quite a bit of time.
Yeah, I was from Springfield, Missouri.
Okay.
But yeah, I bratted back and forth from the Pentagon to Southern California, back and forth about three times.
And Virginia as well?
And those military wives all probably had a lot of ratted hair.
Yeah, my mom and my aunt, and they were all hair hoppers with big black Italian beehives. I found out later, though, that one of my aunts was a competitor in the 60s and, like, national comb-out champion. So it was certainly in the family, and I never knew it. Later,
there was a national comb-out champion?
The hair competitions in America in the 60s and 70s.
Wow. Oh, wow.
They still have them, but...
Well, it's like with my little cowlick up front, sometimes I have to rat that to get it right. Otherwise, it just lays a little flat.
And the hair wars and all that good stuff. But, yeah, It was interesting because I didn't know that. And her daughter, my cousin, said, oh, my God, you know, she used to do all these hairdos that you love now.
Hairspray seems like something that came out of the World War II technology, right? It's like it's not something that necessarily existed in the past before that. Or are you familiar with what women did to their hair before we got aerosol spray cans? Or I'm wondering.
No, not really. I mean, I love researching old hairstyles, and
I knew they would put glue in it and egg whites and all sorts
I've heard of
like,
some of these kooky things like that.
Yeah,
nothing really stands out. Like,
sure, they use like pomades have been around, oils have been around for centuries, of course. Mm-hmm.
But like John Waters was talking about in the movie, the making of the film Pink Flamingos, that he had to bleach the actor's hair and use magic markers to get those bright blue and pink colors because the materials, the chemicals didn't exist at the time.
Well, that's so much further along in the game. I mean, the hairspray, I'm sure it's been around since about the 40s, I would say.
Uh-huh.
And maybe before that, because that's when the hair started being more complicated and you needed some structure.
Now, Perfidia as a character came because of your drag mother gave you, but she has a very much of a Latin American sensibility, and you were well known for performing Ima Sumac's music and Perez Prado and La Lupe and all that stuff.
Yeah, I originally took the concept of the Latin sort of one name character like Charo, and I was also influenced by Lipsinka. So I just thought the one name, or Domvina, the model, these are all things I was kind of fashioning myself after. So the Perfidia thing really worked as like a someone who's kind of mysterious, slightly perfidious, could be maybe a little bit aloof.
Perfidia in English means to be stunned, right? Or flabbergasted.
Yeah, or the way I perceive it, at least from the songs, because it's probably a slightly changed version, but the woman who's got a lot of guys and doesn't really give herself to anyone. She could be perfidious.
Oh, okay.
A perfidious way of being.
Linda Ronstadt came out with an album.
Oh, yeah.
Perfidia.
She does that song.
And it's a really beautiful song. Off the top of my head, I can't remember it, but...
Well, I was working at the Boy Bar, and I started cultivating my act as different characters like that. But Ima Sumac was the one that really stuck. And then since in the 80s, she was going to make a revival, I was lined up and ready to, like, participate, because I'd already been doing it for a while.
Mm-hmm. Revival in her career.
Yeah, well, when she came to New York in the 80s, I think it was 88, was her last round of New York shows. I had already been doing it. So when they had the lookalike contest, I already had the costume, knew the act. So I went there, and most people were dressed in Peruvian traditional costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in the gold sari and the huge feather headdress, and they immediately say, well, you're the winner. And then they said, well, now we're going to invite you to Ima Sumac's party tonight. And I said, I'm the show tonight. Like, they didn't even know that I was the show for the party that they were giving, because I just had infiltrated.
So you got to meet Ima Sumac.
Yeah, I got to meet Ima Sumac. And
did you do lip sync for her? Like,
I did.
Her song?
Yes, I got to lip sync for her, and I have a memorable picture of her in the front row. And apparently she loved men doing her and despised women doing her.
Oh, really?
She was a very, you know, intense woman. And it was so fascinating to meet somebody like that. That's like a magic time bubble for me to imprint my act on her, the real woman. So she took a liking to me. And the opening night, it was me, Terry Mugler, Crisis, Holly Woodlawn, all these legends. And we all rushed into her dressing room afterwards. And she kind of focused on me. And Ima was saying, like, look, the kids love me. Young people love my music still. And, you know, she's like, he has no reference from before.
Well, what an incredible voice, you know, and just, you know, just a character, really.
Yeah, many nights I get to sit backstage on the side and she'd be singing the song and look over and wink at me or something like that. It was so memorable.
So you guys kind of became friends.
Yeah.
And did you ever ask her, like, what was up this rumor that you were Amy Summers from New Jersey and not
Well, let's get it right. Amy Summers. It's Amy Camus.
Amy Camus.
Unfortunately, is Ima Sumac spelled backwards. And from what I believe and have heard the story, it's a disgruntled interviewer said, you know, she didn't give me the answer I wanted, so she's probably just some housewife from Brooklyn or something.
And it was just kind of like a little joke that people kind of took a little
and unfortunately
seriously.
Became a blurb that followed her whole career. She was very sensitive about it. But
really?
If you ever met her, you knew that she was certainly Spanish and from Peru. Like, there was no question.
Was she royalty, though? Or was that just like me saying I'm a drag queen?
That I don't know, but she certainly was elegant, you know, and
well, I've read the Wikipedia, and it's the government just kind of played along with it. They're like, who knows? But of course she's an Inca princess. Look at her.
Yeah. You know? Well, I don't know if you guys have ever interviewed Damien Devine. He's a guy out of L.A., a man. He took care of Ima in her last years, and he learned so much about what was true about her because she kept everything. Her clipping books were out of control. I actually went to see, after she passed away, the estate that was left, and I bought some items. I have a few evening gowns of hers, her shoes. But most impressive was her clipping books, which showed clearly that she came from Peruvian folk singer, local hero, all the way to Hollywood superstar and then Broadway star. I mean, she's one of my
favorites.
She
was like the last living person that died with the secret of where El Dorado, the city of gold, was located.
Yes, something like
and
that.
And now we'll never know.
Well, you have seen the movie Secret of the Incas that she's in, where they go to the real Machu Picchu and shoot. You should research that.
Oh, and is she like going, I am possessed by the spirits of the ancestors?
No, but even in her real life, she always said that she was fascinated by animals, birds, all her life, that there was some connection. And it shows in her music. And like, people that tried to record her or worked with her musically found it hard to use her the way that she would produce music. Yeah, like, because it's not really scatting. It's not really jazz. It's her own thing. It's so unique. Like, she wasn't a, you know, a soprano or a coriata or whatever the...
Mm-hmm. It was very... vocalizations were very unique. My favorite Inca movie, though, is the one with Christopher Plummer where he plays, like, this Inca... Like, the Inca prince when Pizarro comes to town. And he's, like, they're talking, and it's kind of very homoerotic. And then he dances for Pizarro. And it's, like, this crazy over-the-top. And he does all this yelping and making these weird sounds and these dance moves. And then when he's done, he's, like, turns to Pizarro, and he goes, now it's your turn. And the guy is just like, fuck that shit.
Well, a lot of people are probably familiar with Ima Sumac's song Malambo Number 1, which I think Jinx Monsoon and Detox had a lip sync for their life on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah, I was really excited
and
to see
that. And got Detox eliminated. But the great thing is that it, again, introduced this campy piece of music to a whole new generation.
Magical. She would be so happy. Yeah. I'm thrilled that happened because it did. And it, all of a sudden, it gave me another, like, spark of people being interested in what I did before. And again, with her items coming up for sale on eBay and things, like, there's just a lot of interest about her again, and she's a great person to be.
Yeah, Jinx really nailed it too. Yeah. Especially with the hand gestures, because she really did, like, moved with her hands.
What they do in Peru, da 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 da. Whoop. And it's like, wow, 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 wow. Her range was phenomenal, but she was mostly like grunting and squeaking.
I think at the peak, she had five octaves.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would generally say five, but
now it was
the
four
end,
and a half.
More like four, but God, just incredible. So anyway, that's, to get all the way back to the circle of that, I took that act from the East Village, which was kitschy and funny and weird, and brought it uptown to Escuelita, which was kind of somewhere in between the world of early continental in the 80s, continental drag pageants.
So it was very...
titties and collagen.
Female impersonator.
Fish, yes. Hunties, fish.
Beautiful fish. Beautiful, beautiful people.
Latin fish.
I learned so much. And at the time, people wouldn't even go to Escuelita because the reputation was so dark that you might get shot if you were a white queen showing up on 39th and 8th. But I went fearlessly to be in the show, did EMA, blew their minds. People were banging on the tables, ended up becoming the best new star at Escuelita and opening the door for the downtown people to perform uptown because there was no symbiotic relationship at first. The uptown Escuelita girls were one thing and the downtown people were more like boys in drag, more like drag queens.
Thankfully, on Netflix, you can actually watch Perfidia perform Malambo Number 1, Ima Sumac's song. Was that performance that you did for Wigstock in the documentary Wigstock similar to what you did at La Escuelita, or was that adapted for a large stage?
Yes, that was adapted. The one that I actually do in the movie is the Welcome to Havana number.
Oh, that's what it was, yes.
And Bunny does
Bunny
Ima Sumac.
Was, okay, that's
but
what it was.
But you can see me do that number on YouTube when I did it in Japan just last year. I do the same exact number.
With the same outfits and same choreography? Or
slightly
it
different. My choreography has stayed pretty much the same for years, but the outfit changes with my size.
Because here in Chicago, I used to perform at a Brazilian restaurant with Delilah Bouvier, and whose name is Franklin, and now works as a makeup artist at MEC. And he used to do a Carmen Miranda number with that song as well. And it seems like it's kind of like Dreamgirls, and I'm telling you, it's a drag queen standard. Mm-hmm. It's a song that every good drag queen should know how to lip sync well.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I mean, because I liked that it was so obscure. I always liked with my character that even though I was lip syncing, people might not be able to place a face with the character, except what I was presenting.
And advice do you have for Jinx Monsoon and other drag queens who are performing this? Because Jinx is going around the country right now, getting known for performing this now. What advice do you have? Did you learn from doing this song years and years and years?
I mean, it's just such a fun song, and everybody does it differently. I like to do it as Ima. But plenty of people do it as comedy bits and funny opera type things. And yeah, it's just those high notes are just incredible. And the momentum that it has while you're doing it, it's building and building and building. It's so much fun.
And a lot, and it actually made its way into popular culture. I think it was part of the soundtrack of the Robin Williams films Get Snitchy, or I'm not getting.
Get Shorty?
Shorty, I think, is the name of, where he plays a child's TV actor who...
Well, by the end, after that Exotica, there was an Exotica movement in music, and she went back to being a millionaire after that. I mean, she was living fine in Hollywood, but when that happened and she had this on this CD, she really did claim...
Start bringing coin.
She claimed her, you know, the royalty back, and...
Why did, in the early 90s, did gay men fall in love with the music and the sensibility of Exotica, which was really something that American soldiers after World War II discovered in the Pacific and brought home with them to California after, you know, being overseas. Why did gay men fall in love with that? I mean, you saw that in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Pee-wee's Playhouse. You saw it in the B-52 videos. You saw that in a lot of culture at the time.
Yeah, I just think it is something that... it lends itself to that kitschy era, but maybe stuff we weren't exposed to completely at the time. I know I, as a kid, don't really remember Martin Denny or Ima Sumac, stuff like that. But I remember going to tiki bars or Chinese restaurants at the time and thinking, like, this is what it is, you know. And
then thrift store shopping.
Yeah, thrift store shopping.
And all that stuff.
And the East Village scene that I sort of came out of, we were really obsessed with all the classic weird movies and... I think it kind of comes from loving soundtracks, playing soundtracks at clubs instead of dance music. That was kind of a big trend for a while.
So these famous drag queens from Atlanta, RuPaul, Lady Bunny, and the third guy was...
Lahoma and Larry T.
The B-52s did a little music video called Love Shack.
Yep, and there
and
was RuPaul.
And there is a booger queen, RuPaul, before she became a supermodel to the world, and yeah. dancing in the crowd. You were there when RuPaul kind of hit it big time.
Yes.
What's the impact? How did that impact drag queens in your community?
Oh, everybody always loved Kate and Cindy, and Fred are all big on the New York scene of the B-52s.
Okay.
So they're good friends with RuPaul, the whole Atlanta connection. So it just made perfect sense. But of course, the New York people were just kind of proud that RuPaul was out there pushing the envelope. I mean, she was determined, and no one knew who was going to be the standout star.
Did that like influence how people did drag, or did they try to make it more glamorous because they saw the success that RuPaul had, did it not really influence them at all?
I think it definitely influenced people to, you know, clean up their acts if they wanted to go that direction. But it just really opened the door to everything. I mean, it was just such a fun era. And Patricia Field catered to all those clients that were RuPaul's friends or RuPaul. I mean, plenty of times she came in and hit that sale rack and cleaned up with amazing costumes. And Pat's was really the nucleus for wardrobe. If it wasn't custom made, it was coming out of Pat's and vintage, of course.
And then D-Light was kind of the soundtrack to that whole scene and generation. World Click, Groove is in the Heart.
Groove is in the Heart was the first little... What is Love?
What is Love?
Is the first thing that came out from them.
Ooh,
and
they played it at Larry T's
Love Machine. And Johnny Dinell was the DJ, and RuPaul was the host, and Lahoma. I'll never forget it, because it's one of those New York moments where everyone looked up and thought, oh my God, Keir is going to be a huge star, and so is Dimitri, because they were already beloved. Mm-hmm. But when we heard that first cut, and then boom, Groove is in the Heart came, and the momentum was out of control. Actually, Glamamore, the drag queen, did the Poochie costume that's in the video that Miss Lady Keir wears. And if you look at that video, it's everybody that I know and love, including Taboo. I mean, it is a who's who. Unfortunately, I didn't make it. I was working or something that day. But that video really just...
For a Groove is in the Heart.
Groove is in the Heart for...
D-Light.
D-Light. Yeah, that was an amazing moment of showing the world, like, what's going on in New York.
Well, and around the country, then, that sensibility influenced drag queens and club kids everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so, literally overnight, people were wearing those pumps, the hair color got more vivid, people were wearing fake fur.
That's where the wigs came from. I mean, she was a big wig wearer. Of course, all the drag queens were. And then when you had her endorsing the drag scene, the drag queens were all wearing wigs, the girls were all wearing wigs. It was just a wig moment, like a wig renaissance.
And that drove prices down in wigs, in a sense, because there was more demand. And so people were able to, you know, because I remember, like, when I first started dressing up in drag, you had to go to thrift stores. I was living in Austin, Texas. And there were not these dedicated African-American lady wig stores like you have today that are like a block long with tons of inventory. Mm-hmm. You had maybe like 20 wigs, and they were for cancer patients, and it looked sad and conservative looks. And then suddenly overnight you had vivid radioactive colors and all sorts of stuff. And it was really like a creative explosion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because the wig business, as I was watching it, had started fading out from the Fiorucci thing, which was the spiky Cher type of post Studio 54 type wigs. And then there was a void for a minute. And then I came in with the 60s styles and 70s styles. And at first people were just like, this is not merchandise. This is just for display, right? And then gradually it kept building and building.
Because you worked at the store that you worked at didn't even carry wigs at first. And then you decided I'll sell a couple. And
yeah, at Patricia Field. We introduced just like five styles. And the manager and Pat herself were just sort of surprised one day, all of a sudden, $500 out of this tiny little makeup department, that's a lot of makeup you got to sell, or five wigs. So gradually, I lost interest in the makeup department, and she said, look, I'm just going to move you to this side of the store, go to it. And she gave me something like a $30,000 budget, and we were fully realized.
Wigs is big business. I think I read something recently. It's like it's $1 billion industry in the United States alone, at least.
Yeah, and it's ended up in New York. It's ended up in the 14th Street. Has become a wig mecca. Mm-hmm. So when I had the wig bar, there were certainly less resources. So I really had a market niche. Mm. Now you can go on the internet too and find anything you want.
Here in Chicago, I think it was last year, there's been at least two shops that have been ripped off in the middle of the night, and one of them for $90,000, and when the other one for $70,000 worth of wig merchandise. And it's just it's big money. And it's just what are you going to do? Fill up your van full of human hair and just sell it out of your van?
Now, in the early 90s, mid 90s, there was the rise of club kid culture. And that, I think the big difference, how do you tell the difference between a club kid and a drag queen? One of them wears a wig, the other one dyes their hair the color of the wig.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to do a bunny zinger right there because I felt it coming.
I know, I didn't have one.
I was trying to impromptu one there, and damn it.
But you could say 50 pounds. Or something like that. But
How I sort of saw it coming was the Drag Queens of New York. And did you ever see that book by chance? The Drag Queens of New York?
I had a copy of it. Yeah.
I think we still have it.
That really gave all of us a nice boost too, as far as world exposure or just being local celebs.
I'm in a book.
The problem is that it was like reading about porn but not actually seeing it. you were kind of it made you more frustrated because you couldn't see what they were talking about. And reading about Joey Arias, for example, but not hearing him sing.
Oh yeah,
Billie Holiday.
And he does an amazing Ima Sumac too
with no effects, just his own voice.
Joey Arias is one of the most influential performers in my life. Aside from International Crisis, he was one of the first people to take me under his wing, put me in his act. I mean, me and another queen, Lulu, were backup dancers for him for years. Worked at the Palladium, every fancy club. And he worked at Fiorucci's at the time. So he was kind of like I was to Pat Field 10 years earlier or 5 years earlier. Okay. I became the person at the store that not only I was a nightclub celebrity, but I was also efficient at my job and willing to help and wanting to lift up new
talent.
You
seem you're the sane person in the mad world of everybody's on drugs and showing up late to work and procrastinating. And here you are cranking out 20 wigs a day or more.
At my peak, I was doing that kind of thing. And
Why were you so together when everybody else was so
hey, I,
such
I
a
had
hot
my
mess.
Crazy, messy times too. I got Pat ripped me a new asshole many a time. But I think it's my military upbringing. I never wanted to be the guy that was late. I never wanted to be the guy that was disappointing or not my word, or a liar. Those things are instilled so early in me.
And even though your name, Perfidia, basically means liar, cheat.
And then even one other layer is the sort of southern thing you mentioned, coming from California in New York, it kind of did give me a slightly friendlier edge that I've never lost completely, as opposed to, say, perhaps some jaded other...
Velvet rage.
Bitter queens, yeah.
And so the rise of drag queens and wig stock kind of mirrored the rise of club kids in New York City. And so you guys came together and were actually doing shows together and performing.
Yeah, the wig stock, again, I call it the wig stock generation. We had a good, I'd say, 5 or 6 years before any other scene infiltrated. And then when the rave music came in, that was kind of where it happened, where the drag queen scene was more hooked to house music and Paradise Garage and Sound Factory and these deeper... And Roxy, of course. Roxy was everything. Roxy booked every one of us for years, so...
Roxy was a nightclub in
Roxy Discotheque in New York, yeah, on 10th and 18th. Every great person that I admire worked there at one point.
And the club kid scene kind of culminated with Michael Alec being arrested for the murder of Angel.
Limelight was looking for something new, and it had kind of gone on a wave similar to the one here, and he came in and brought in Disco 2000 and started creating this club kid thing based on Lee Bowery and some other more avant-garde looks. So the drag queens were welcome and working, but the club kids were really doing something new
And for people who may not be familiar who Lee Bowery is, can you describe his drag style? Because it was basically, I can say it's like bizarre, taking sofa cushions, cutting out eye holes, and be able to see through them, and then strapping them to his head.
Lee Bowery is the performance artist from Australia who lived in London. He was best friends with Boy George. And they created so many looks, along with Tasty Tim, another good friend of mine from London, trying to break all the barriers, and London was so good for that anyhow. But
the freakier, the better.
Freakier, the better. And Lee Bowery, eventually they wrote the... Boy George wrote the musical Taboo.
Based on his life.
Based on both of their lives, which I worked on that in New York. And that was an amazing experience to see George as Lee. I think that confused a lot of people because they wanted to see George as George. But the guy who was playing George was the young, beautiful character.
I heard that Rosie O'Donnell drove that musical to the ground.
She was intense to be around, but the musical itself was still brilliant, but it just...
I heard it got a bad rap. I mean, it didn't last too long, did it?
Edgy stuff doesn't last long in New York. If you get it up and running for 3 months, and it's... You're lucky, because things, especially now, are closing very quickly, but it was just so cool. I mean, how else can I say it? I've been on so many Broadway shows, and there's never been anything like that about a person like Boy George... The real story. So yeah, the matinee ladies didn't like it. Mm-hmm. But the people that came, if they could have kept it open somehow, it was almost getting the Rocky Horror Show momentum, mm-hmm. where people were coming fully dressed up, buying the front row every night. You know, kids saw that show every time it performed. Some mm-hmm. kids, you know, like
had were there.
A ticket for every night. And I just love George so much. He's a huge influence on
us. So club kid culture kind of got its air deflated when Michael Alec was arrested for the murder of Angel Melendez, his drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And Wigstock grew so big and so popular that it became cost prohibitive and probably difficult to do for Lady Bunny until she just stopped doing it altogether.
Yeah, you know, you'd think that the city would be thankful and go kiss her ass for creating a huge event that filled every restaurant, every store. For me at Pat Fields, we sold hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise just for that event. So it was very sad to see it go.
But it was a gay culture wasn't as appreciated back then as it is today.
Well, I mean, I think it is. I mean, it became the biggest festival in New York.
But it wasn't as respected today as it is back then. Well, I mean, it's not.
Do you think it's just homophobia, why they didn't want to kind of promote it? Or
no.
Was it too gender transgressive?
I just think it was about money. Yeah. I don't think they love drag, and I don't think it was anything to do with drag, just money, money, money.
So meanwhile, all this is happening and deflating and kind of dying out. Here you are getting known on Broadway as Broadway's go-to wig guy.
I have had a very fun, successful Broadway career. I actually left Pat Fields and I did Strangers with Candy for 2 seasons.
You're the guy who made Jerry Blank's wigs?
Yep.
I have no idea.
I did not do the first season, which is slightly different.
Okay.
But when she started to have the little flip in her hair is the season I came on, and she had specifically said, like, I like this general look, but give me something else to play with.
Oh, I had no idea. Did you actually base that choice on the documentary?
Completely.
Oh.
The wig was already created. So when I came in the second season, I only knew a little bit about the show.
Yeah.
But I grew to love Amy Sedaris, everyone, Stephen Colbert. It's an amazing show. And if you go back now and look at those 2 seasons, you can see a lot of my flavor in them. So I left Pat Fields to do Strangers with Candy. And then through that, I was invited to just swing on Broadway, which is fill in someone's track. Started Miss Saigon, Les Mis, Aida, kept working my way up. And then when I got Taboo as a full-time employee, that's when it really got big for me. Even though I have yet to design a full Broadway show, I designed Miss Yvonne's hair for the Pee Wee Herman show on Broadway, which I was nominated for an Emmy.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
Emmy nominated.
And you also did a wig for Cherry.
Cherry wears a wig. She wears a bumpet in the show. And working with Paul was one of the most wonderful things. Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman. Mm-hmm. He is one of the sweetest guys. And he also, when they were setting up the show, was having trouble finding someone to tease hair. You'd think on Broadway.
Yeah.
So the original concept they weren't liking it because everything else was bigger than life, and out walked Miss Yvonne. They wanted Miss Yvonne. So they had a sort of a throwaway sample wig. They said, show us what you can do on this, and maybe we'll let you do Miss Yvonne. The wig that I did ended up being the one she wore the entire run because she was obsessed with it, and he was as well. It was huge teased thing. And
were you at any time where you're making it was like, maybe I shouldn't make it too big. Well, maybe I shouldn't make it too crazy.
They had me make it slightly smaller.
Uh-huh.
But Paul was so, so supportive.
Paul Rubens, Paul the man Rubens who plays
is so supportive,
Herman.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And just got a sense, I would guess, kind of like what you guys are getting off of me. He was like, this is good energy. This is what I want. Not mm-hmm. someone that's telling me they can't do this, that whatever you want, I'm going to do that.
Well, I've given you a challenge. My drag mother is Lady Bunny, and my drag sister spirit is Tura Santana from Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And so we bought two wigs. And I just say, fuse the looks together into one new look that is glamorous, hot, fierce, and expensive.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's having that knowledge of things like that is a big part of my styling. When someone says to me Valley of the Dolls or Tura Santana, I know what that means. So there's a lot in referencing classic movies and even MGM stuff and Bob Fosse, and that's all really big. In fact, my look the other night when I went out with you was very Sweet Charity inspired. So yeah. I do take things from Broadway.
So the drag mm-hmm. photo that is on today's show, that's from Sweet Charity?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of those feelings, the big teased hair and the sort of trashy.
Yeah, because you could totally look, you know, serving up some Dame Edna realness with that.
Well, Dame Edna's more 50s, right?
Yeah, she's more 50s, and she's more that, you know, the older lady kind of
matronly
thing.
You look sort of like, you know, you could be a British aristocrat.
Oh, all easily, right. You know? I always fashion myself after Gypsy Rose Lee. That's one person that I just kind of have that sense that I'm like her.
Well, it's just amazing, like the work that you've done, the some of the things that we've seen you work on. It's just like, I just, what's the I guess I'm trying to figure out how I'm gonna wedge my joke in here, because you'd mentioned something the other day about you use a wig oven, and I don't, like, after you left, Foster was so excited about it. I don't think anybody's been so excited about an oven since Adolf Hitler came up with his Final Solution.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
Ouch. And so explain to the listener, you actually put wigs in an oven.
We apologize for that joke.
That's sick.
Well, because a lot of people don't realize that you actually, like, in order to set these wigs, you stick them in a giant oven.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to style a wig. One of the first ways that I learned to style a wig was with electric rollers on synthetic. That works very well.
Terrible, Mark.
I know. So bad.
But so you put the wigs in the oven.
But the Broadway wigs, what you do is you set it with water. You know, you roll it on a roller with water, and you put it in the wig oven, and that bakes the style into a human hair wig.
Now, can I just cook it in my regular oven?
Probably, but I don't know what would happen.
It would just melt.
You need the air blowing. The wig oven is a circulation of
hot air. And
you
probably need a lower heat.
Well, it depends.
Oh, really?
I love to bake that stuff.
So you can, like, how high can you go on that?
It's pretty hot, yeah.
Like 300-400 degrees? Could you also cook, like, a turkey in there if you wanted to?
No, but people do occasionally warm up a macaroni salad.
Oh, wow.
What? Are you kidding me? You actually can heat up,
food in there,
wig thing? But then your wig starts smelling like, you know, leftovers.
Well, we try not to do them together. But I quite often will. The last theater I was at, the Barrymore Theater, it was really cold. We were on the sixth floor. So I would climb into the wig oven, which is really comfortable.
It's that big?
It's that big. It's very comfortable.
So it's like a sauna.
It's like a little mini sauna, except no guys there.
Could you bring a wig and heat set it inside a regular old sauna? Would that work?
I don't
think
so.
It's
not as focused.
Because what are you really setting in there? Is it you're making the hair stay, or you just have like a glue that you have on there, and that's what's really...
No, it's just like a blow dryer when the intense heat is on there.
Now, we got to wrap up this fascinating podcast interview with you.
But, yeah, it's been fun.
Before we go, I have a couple questions. Where you were saying that the word hunty does not originate from RuPaul's Drag Race and Raven, but a drag queen named Gerlina, who goes now by the name Lena, coined it.
Yes, Lena is one of the most popular, I would say, dancing, twirling queens They called her Twirlina. And in her own language, she would fuse words constantly, like Twirlina. And everyone knew that meant she was going to tear it up on the dance floor. And Hunty comes from that period when Kevin Ambiance had the song Cunty.
Oh.
Everything kind of started morphing and having these unty ends. And Hunty is the one that stuck. And then, of course, the Scissor
Sisters.
Say that
again. Wait. Say that again, because I'm going to soak that in.
Auntie-isms?
Auntie-isms.
Auntie. It's cunty, cheeky, but cunty just was one that was...
Cunty.
The girls in New York, I'm sure here too, if you look great, they say, oh, she looks cunt. Mm-hmm. But then if she's being shady, oh, she's being cunty.
Yeah.
Or if she's dancing fierce, it could be good or bad. Let's like...
So why does she like merge the word honey and cunt?
Well, because she was... using both words separately.
Yeah. Honey, cunt.
Yeah, and she was big on the honey. Oh, honey, this, and, you know.
Huh.
And it got fused. Cunty and honey turned into hunty.
Is she mad that Raven is going around claiming that she's the one who coined the phrase? It's attributed to Tyler Perry.
Lena's out there on nice, toasty Fire Island getting ready for her season, and she giggled when I sent her asked her to authenticate the original.
And did she authenticate it?
Yeah, she said yes. So
there you go, people.
Because we had reported before we did the show with Mimi, I'm first from RuPaul's Drag Race. We're talking about drag words, and Mimi credited Raven from season two.
See, I think Mimi's too young to know. I mean, mm-hmm. God bless her.
Yeah,
but
she's this too is talking young to know a lot of things.
We're talking the mid 80s, early 90s, and Kevin Ambiance and that whole group of queens had plenty of words that were completely unique.
On this season of RuPaul's Drag Race, one of the major themes has been the classic versus the romantic debate, whether the perfume, the scent of the perfume is more important than the bottle, whether the notion or the idea behind the poetry is more than the prose, whether the way a drag queen looks versus what a drag queen says and does, right? It's like comedy queen versus pageant queen.
Mm-hmm.
How are you interpreting that debate or that discussion? What do you think about it?
Well, just having been in drag for so long, I love all the different facets. So I'm just as interested in the continental queens as I am with the P-Town queens that do live shows and all that stuff. There's just so much in every little thing.
How do you see yourself?
I would say I'm more of a comedian, an entertainer.
But you get hired to do styling. I mean, that's your bread and butter.
Yeah, I mean, the hair thing is my main focus, but I've always fashioned myself and thought of myself as the performer first. And the reason I'm a good stylist is because I have all these visions of how I might use this on stage on myself or on anybody.
Do you feel that Roxy Andrews got a unfair treatment in the editing of the show, that pageant queens were a little bit on the brunt end of the editing this season, or do you feel like those cunty hunty bitches got what they deserved?
I think that she was amazing. I really enjoyed her act because I haven't seen much of that in New York. We don't have that exact little niche where she's been cultivated by her drag mothers, and you see it in her style. It's so unique and beautiful, like. I love her. I think she's fantastic. And that's what's so great about the show. You see all these people coming from different drag families and drag family tree. That's a big part of what I see and what I find interesting. Like here, JoJo Baby has all these disciples. And in New York, Bunny...
Sissy Spastic,
yeah, and
Sally.
Bunny has all her kids. And RuPaul now has her whole kids, her whole hierarchy. And I just love it. I mean, especially what RuPaul's doing now. I think it's so much fun to... contrast and see some dark sides, but when they started editing in the sensitive side, as dramatic as it is with the music and the violence, mm-hmm. I think RuPaul has really done a lot for just putting these stories out there, because so many drag queens had families who didn't want them, didn't care, and now all of a sudden they're like, oh, you're so great, you're on TV. I mean, I had a similar experience where I hadn't talked to my family in a long time. And once I won the Emmy and started to be a serious
person. You won the person, Emmy.
Well, nominated, excuse
nominated.
Me. Edit that out. Once I was nominated for the Emmy, all of a sudden they thought, oh, well, he's not just screwing around in New York or running off to Japan for no reason. Like, there's a reason. It's my career. And
you're one of the world's best.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I like to fashion myself that way.
I mean, it's undisputed, I think, probably. Who do you think is going to... who are you rooting for, or can you even say who you're rooting for to win this season of Drag Race?
You know, why? I love them all. I think they're all really fun. I like Alaska just so much, just because she was so incredibly nice to me. When I met her in L.A., her and Sharon Needles had said, hey, we watch Wigstock all the time. We love to get our friends to see it, because that's kind of what we looked up to when they were 5 and 6 and 10 years old. I mean, how old were they?
They're not that young.
But they're pretty darn young.
God damn. They try to act like they're barely legal. And they're like, I'm like, Sharon Needles keeps like rubbing in Peaches Christ's face. Like, I'm just so young. I don't know any. I'm like, you guys are like 4 years apart.
Yeah, 7, I think.
Well, you know, I mean, actually, a little tidbit of history is there would probably be no Wigstock the movie if it weren't for Alexis Arquette. He came to New York, he saw what was happening in the drag scene and was completely blown away, and came back the next year with the video camera. And the footage they shot the first year is not used at all. And then the following 2 years is what they ended up using. Mm. But if it weren't for him, there would have been no money, no interest, nothing.
Her now, because she fully transitioned.
No, that's not true.
That's not true?
Okay. I don't want to put words in her mouth, and I've talked to her personally. She's doing lots of experimenting.
Is she living as a woman now, or we don't know?
I don't think so. I think that it's for fun. Okay. I think what she did on MTV was for fun and to give that character a voice.
Interesting.
But I think she was doing it intentionally. Like, there's no transition character on TV. Even though I'm not transitioning, let me be that character. Let me be that voice.
Really?
Yeah, I don't believe.
That's not
breaking
as a
news,
woman?
People.
No, I could be wrong, but being a personal friend with her.
Never heard this before.
I would say Alexis Arquette is a talented actor that is a man that loves to be seen in drag. I don't think that he's transitioning, but if he is, sister, pardon me, but.
So as far as you know, he hasn't had breast augmentation.
No, it's a different sensibility, like a Candace Kane, where I'm living as a woman.
Sure.
But I could be wrong. People change. But I've always seen Alexis as this beautiful boy that's so fucking talented.
Oh, yeah. He was gorgeous.
Let's talk about the way drag queens over-elaborate their costumes and Velvet Rage. yesterday's show, we talked a little bit about Velvet Rage with Peaches Christ, which is how gay men tend to not feel good enough or worthy enough about things.
There's a lot of shame, and so there's a lot of validation, or you can't really take criticism, and so sometimes that is, exemplified through, like, our snarkiness or cattiness, and sometimes, you know, our velvet rage that simmers beneath.
And then one of the dark horses of drag queens and drag culture is that we tend to rely too much, I would say, on how we look and the costumes and the props. I always say this to, like, Mimi, I'm first. I'm like, they're there to see you, to celebrate you, and whatever you bring onto that stage, as long as you're passionate about it, is going to be celebrated by the audience. And unfortunately, for many drag queens, they're literally, Mimi, I'm first brings the entire attic, the kitchen sink of props and puppets and Gucci's and
I am
gizmos.
All for it.
You love that.
I think it's a very New York sensibility, as opposed to a pageant queen that might give you a black gown and a worked on body. Someone from New York is going to bring you the joke bag and every trick they got up their sleeve, exploding wigs, funny things under the costume. I mean, I love that.
And yet you live in a city where square footage is extremely challenging. There's no place to store anything.
That's another fascinating thing, to walk into someone's apartment that is of this career and see how they make it work and how they hide things and incorporate things.
Where do you store all your stuff now?
Well, I have a big drag closet, you know, like I just happen to be lucky enough to have one. And Misunderstood and I go to Thailand and get a lot of our costumes there by people very similar to what Sequin Queen produces.
Okay.
But if you go to Bangkok yourself, you can have it custom made for you. So she and I picked up on that a few years ago and have been going for many years. In fact, everything
she goes
for
like a month. Do you go for a month as well?
Yeah, I go for a month and more. And the costumes are just insane. And I would puddle jump from New York to Tokyo to Thailand, get a new wardrobe, and then go back to Tokyo and kill them. And then if I wanted to, sell off half of it.
And do you speak any Thai or Japanese?
I do. I speak a little Japanese and a little Thai, and most of the languages that I learn through drag queens or have a slight inflection that people of that culture recognize immediately. They're like, you're talking like a girl.
Oh, wow.
Because the feminine...
They have tones.
Yeah, and the feminine and masculine things in the languages... and I learned,
I can speak tranny in five different languages.
I speak tranny in Japanese. and tranny in Thai is even more evolved. It is so spectacular, the language that
like
they
created. Could you give us a little example of, like, can you say it like a guy and then maybe say it like a girl would say?
Uh-huh. Well, just simple, a simple one, hello. A guy would say, sawadee kap, and a queen would say, sawadee ka. It's got this nasal kind of, It's fascinating. And like screaming and like, oh God, it's so much fun. Thailand is the most transsexual.
We gotta go.
Yeah, next time you go, we'll go along with you.
Mm. Ooh, and I will learn very important words in Thailand.
You sound Chinese all of a sudden, though.
Oh, really? That's okay. I'm sorry, I messed up.
It's pretty close.
Let's talk one last thing. This viral video that we're addicted to, which we just found out through you, was Moi Renee, a drag queen who's no longer with us, and she's singing a song that she wrote called Miss Honey, which is, can't you hear me calling you Miss Honey?
Now, Miss Honey was a huge hit in New York. Mm-hmm. She also had another slightly less famous one called Acid Head. But Moi Renee was one of the first performers doing avant-garde drag and trying to put it out there in the house music world. And she did it. I mean, before Kevin Aviance, before any of them, she had two singles that were on the dance charts, and I just loved her a lot. She worked at Cafe Con Leche, which was a club that I co-produced in New York, and was always a huge, huge hit.
How do you interpret that dress? She passed on because of complications of HIV and AIDS, right?
Yes, like so many mm-hmm. people.
And that dress that she wears in the video, Miss Honey, to me seems like a stylization or commentary on the cancer that a lot of people with HIV and AIDS.
Well, is it the chains that she's wearing?
No, she's wearing spots all over her body.
Okay.
And they're like cut out to show the skin, but they're also like painted on. And to me, I was like, I wonder if anybody interpreted it, or was that an intentional comment on the HIV sarcoma. And AIDS? Kaposi sarcoma.
I don't think so. At that time, there was a lot of stuff coming from London and Body Map and costumes like that. People were obsessed with Rudy Gernreich. So the cutout thing was just a very big thing back then. I don't think it's related to the HIV.
Well, I watch that video probably at least once a month. He's like, I need a little Miss Honey.
It cheers you up.
Well, there's another version out there where she's wearing this dress of chains.
Oh, really?
So maybe it's a little bit deeper searching, but she's a great character to
You've
reference.
Seen so much in drag. You've been, RuPaul likes to describe all this stuff, culture as a
colostomy bag.
As a colostomy bag. No, as the, when you blow wind into like a fire.
What's a bellows? A bellow.
As bellows, opening and closing, breathing, contracting and expanding. And right now we're an expansion of decadence and elaborate and gay culture and cheerfulness. Where do you see all this going right now where we are? Hopefully indefinitely, or do you see there's going to be a backlash?
I think with the combination of RuPaul and Lady Gaga, things like that, kids today have every right and every interest in dressing up, and they should go for it. Why not? And it's interesting because in Japan, costume play is just a part of culture to release your stress and stuff. And even though we kind of accept it here, we sometimes point the finger at, like, why you got to wear a wig to get noticed? Because it's fun. And like, people might look in the mirror and want to see something different. So I think it's great. And in New York, too, it's really coming back up. Suzanne Barsh got back in the business, and she is one of the number one club promoters in New York.
She left the business for a while?
Yeah, she had a kid, and she was married to David Barton. Mm-hmm. She brought back what she had done for us in the 80s and the 90s, which was Copacabana and Bentley's and all these things for drag queens to work and perform at. She was neutral for a long time, came back, and boom, the fire was started again with those kids. And that includes like Dirty Martini and Kavron, and there's a bunch of new... Although now they're 10 years in the biz, but...
But to you, they're new.
Yeah, or even 5 years in the biz.
Because RuPaul was new to you.
Once upon a time. And we came right neck and neck. I would say we were just right at that same time. 86, a magic year for those drag performers. And those people stayed relevant. It's interesting. Like, those 86, 87 people that wanted to continue, they're still relevant. Thank God.
Thank God. And thank God you're still with us. Stephen Perfidia Kirkham, or Perfidia.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for all your contribution to so many people's lives. You made the world a better place.
Oh, that's so sweet. Don't touch my mustache. That's how I learned how to say, doitashimashite, which is, I think it's you're welcome.
Oh.
In Japanese.
In Japanese.
And someone said, it sounds just like, don't touch my mustache.
Don't touch my mustache.
And oh. I'd used it and it worked.
Don't touch my mustache.
What we got for you as a little present is Hunty t-shirt.
Yay.
And it looks like, it, you know, the logo of some fabulous college or university. And it is,
Hunty. You?
It is a school, Hunty.
Yes. The library is open.
Yeah. I love the School of Drag. I think you got to, I'd like to be an ambassador to the School of Drag.
Time to start reading.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's our gift to you. And for you listeners out there, we can't do the show without your support and your t-shirts. If you buy a t-shirt, it helps support this show. So get one at feastoffun.com/store.
Hunty. And you can also follow Stephen Perfidia Kirkham on Facebook.
Yes, I'm there. I have my private site, and I also have the wig styling site, which people can see styles and get inspiration.
And they can actually hire you to go show up at a party or do wigs through Misunderstood's
yes,
site?
Yes, through screamingqueens.com. We send out our girls as well as ourselves occasionally.
Are you like more expensive or cheaper than the other girls?
Well,
are they all the same price?
No, the kids with the RuPaul endorsement now get the big bucks.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, we've been in the business for a long time, and $500 is a really pretty decent rate for a unknown.
Mm-hmm.
These girls are getting $1,000, $2,000. You know, it's the demand is there.
But you don't have to do the dessert table, like walking around as the dessert table.
That's one of the funnest gigs, honestly. I have not been in the table in years, but I have done it a couple times. It's really, really fun.
Where you dress up as a dessert table and you actually have real desserts on
you. Well, the table looks like a giant Marie Antoinette skirt.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And
but it has wheels and you're like walking around and you're like,
it is so much fun.
Besides yourself, like, what drag queens would you like to see on RuPaul's Drag Race?
I wish she would do an old timers and get like drag queens that are 50 years and older. I think that would be really good. Even if it wasn't New York drag queens, an old timers episode or season would be great, because we're getting all this young impressions and the young kids' ideas. But to see somebody like, say, a Chili Pepper, somebody mm-hmm. who's so evolved, and get them on there. They don't like to be in competitions anymore, but I think that would be fascinating. Or a Mimi Marks, or somebody that is so famous in our world, but hasn't been splashed on the bigger world yet.
And for the younger queens, who would you like to see?
Well, I think Epiphany Got Paid is right up there with people that would be adored once they were on there.
And he's a cute boy, too.
He's fuckable. Yeah.
And
totally.
Just talented. I mean,
we did this panel at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center here in town, and I didn't realize he was Epiphany. When I sat down, I was like, "Damn, honey, you show is fine." And uh-huh. I was like, "That's the drag queen?"
And see, again,
damn.
That's another group that I would consider the newcomers.
Yeah.
But her and Acid Betty came in and they kind of swept in town like I did in my day and took over. I mean, mm-hmm. they worked everywhere. They were the most outrageous. And, you know, there's always that wave of the new people are the most dressed up, and the people that have, you know, can sit back a little bit and let them be the stars.
And technology-wise, we're starting to see a lot more airbrushing. Like, and one thing I noticed, like Willem and all these queens were doing, they're doing a lot more contouring, but they're also using aerosol sprays mm-hmm. to contour. That's not paint, but actual foundation.
Yeah, and I even remember the old hairspray on the face trick to supposedly seal the makeup. I don't know if there's any truth in it.
Oh, it doesn't ever actually
But I've seen it.
I used to do that for years. It did work. So, Stephen Perfidia Kirkham, I could talk about this with you all day, all night long.
Hairspray your face.
Don't hairspray your face. It's not good for you.
Well, close your eyes if you're going to hairspray.
Okay, and hold your breath.
And hold your breath.
And you got to get a good teasing comb. If you don't have that, you got nowhere
Speaking
to go.
Speaking of which, let's get on those wigs, girls.
Bye, Hunty.
Hunty.
Bye.